characteristics about the pattern formed by the dots. Their distribution, for example, was not at all even. The areas of the maps on which the dots were clustered most thickly corresponded in the main to those areas inhabited by families that were well-to-do, or at least comfortable. The areas of the maps on which the dots were sprinkled most thinly corresponded in part to undeveloped outlying areas of the city that did not really need playgrounds, but they corresponded also to some of the city's most congested areas, to the tenement neighborhoods and slums inhabited by families that were poor, to areas that needed playgrounds desperately. Most of Robert Moses' neighborhood playgrounds had, in other words, been built in the neighborhoods that needed playgrounds least. Few of the playgrounds had been built in the neighborhoods that needed playgrounds most. The areas of the maps on which the dots were sprinkled most thinly of all corresponded to those areas of the city inhabited by its 400,000 Negroes. Robert Moses built 255 playgrounds in New York City during the 1930s. He built one playground in Harlem. An overspill from Harlem had created Negro ghettos in two other areas of the city, Brooklyn-Stuyvesant Heights, the nucleus of the great slum that would become known as Bedford-Stuyvesant, and South Jamaica. Robert Moses built one playground in Stuyvesant Heights. He built no playgrounds in South Jamaica. "We have to work all day, and we have no place to send the children," one Harlem mother had written before Robert Moses became park commissioner. "There are kids here who have never played any place but in the gutter." She could have written the same words after he had been park commissioner for 5 years. After a building program that had tripled the city's supply of playgrounds, there was still almost no place for approximately 200,000 of the city's children, the 200,000 with black skin, to play in their own neighborhoods, except the streets or abandoned, crumbling, filthy, looted tenements stinking of urine and vomit, or vacant lots carpeted with rusty tin cans, jagged pieces of metal, dog feces, and the leavings spilling out of rotting paper shopping bags of human meals. Children with white skin had been given swings and seesaws and sliding ponds. Children with black skin had been left with the old broomsticks that served them as baseball bats. Children with white skin had been given wading pools to splash in summer. If children with black skin wanted to escape the heat of the slums, they could remove the covers from fire hydrants and wade through their outwash, as they had always waded, in gutters that were sometimes so crammed with broken glass that they glistened in the sun. Negroes begged for playgrounds. The children begged silently, recalls Father C. Edward Harrison, who during the 1930s served as assistant to Father Shelton Hale Bishop, rector of St. Philip's Protestant Episcopal Church on 134th Street. They wouldn't say they had no place to go. The need was unexpressed, inarticulate. But you knew that in their own way they were begging for somewhere to go, something to do. There weren't even basketball courts then, except at the Y or in the big parks. There was nothing in the neighborhood, and you would see kids improvising basketball baskets, hanging a fruit basket against a lamppost or against a wall, you know, hanging it up on something, playing on the sidewalks or in the streets. In 1944, Father Bishop would persuade his parishioners to convert the old four-story parish house, which contained a gymnasium, into a community center with recreational facilities. And, Father Harrison recalls, "You should have seen the kids come in here, just because we had a gym. The very fact that they came here in such numbers and were so happy to have something to do showed us how much they needed recreational facilities." Not just because of the gym, of course. There were recreation supervisors there who cared about the children. "It's not just recreation that we're talking about, you know," Father Harrison says. "I guess you could call it an involvement of ourselves. They felt they belonged here, and that they were wanted here, that someone cared about them. Recreation has to go along with other things, you know." But that was precisely what playgrounds were providing in other areas of the city. In the 30s, recalls Park Department official Melvin Douse, the Park Department playground supervisors were young guys, bright young guys, all college educated. There were no other jobs available then. We were trained in working with young people, supervising them, giving them leadership, giving them help. And what with WPA and all, there were so many supervisors, there were two or three at even the smallest playground, that we could really get involved with the kids, not just supervise their games, but be around, so that if one of them needed someone to talk to, he had someone. I mean, a kid would never come around and say right out, "I need some advice," but kids were saying that in their own way. They were saying it silently, but they were saying it all right. They were begging for it. Adults begged aloud, in letters to the editor and resolutions to the mayor, and their voices sometimes grew shrill and desperate. "The police just keep the kids moving, and there is no place to send them," one Stuyvesant Heights mother said. "Harlem is a poor section," one civic organization wrote LaGuardia. "Each day, from morning to night, those people who are trying to give their children a decent living and make them something in the world to be proud of are out at work, trying to earn a living." It was impossible for them to stay home and care for their children at the same time. Therefore, they wanted to send them to playgrounds. Since there weren't any, the children had little choice but to roam the streets while their parents are worried half to death wondering where they are. "Please realize and understand the conditions of Harlem, in order that you might see what the children there have to contend with." Ministers and settlement house workers attempting to alleviate the problem through their own efforts found a particular poignance in their inability to make any real dent in it. The crowds of children who tried to jam into Reverend Bishop's little parish house only impressed him the more with the fact that only the city could do the job on the scale required. "We knew the need," Father Bishop's assistant, Father Harrison, says. "We couldn't understand why the city didn't. When you have to turn kids away, the feeling is one of anger, frustration, of why? And sometimes the anger and frustration would spill over in angry speeches. Reverend Bishop, who was to try for 10 years to persuade Robert Moses to build one playground in his neighborhood, reading, almost every time he picked up a newspaper, it seemed, of another new playground being opened in some other neighborhood, addressed himself to the problem of Harlem crime by telling an audience, "The children have no place to go. Day and night they must use the block on which they live for recreation. No wonder they are like caged tigers, and, once loose, want to wreak havoc." But the adults might as well have been silent, too. LaGuardia, who was doing so much in other areas for the city's Negroes, was not interfering with his park commissioner, and he referred the resolutions to him. And his park commissioner flatly denied their contentions. "The fact is that Harlem and its adjacent neighborhoods have not been overlooked and neglected or discriminated against," Robert Moses said. "The tendency has been in just the other direction, that is to give more attention to Harlem than to other sections which are in just as great need of recreation." He had done this with all the Negro slums, he said, and he bolstered his arguments with floods of facts and figures compiled by his corps of statisticians. The facts and figures were misleading, but no one did the work necessary to disprove them. The first full-scale survey of recreational facilities by any organization other than the Park Department, a United Parents Association study which found plenty of playground space only where rentals are high, was not conducted until 1941, and it was not until 1943 when a grand jury investigating the causes of the high crime rate in Bedford-Stuyvesant found lack of recreational facilities to be a contributing factor that any even quasi-official body went on record about the effect of Moses Park policies on the Negro slums. Moses' reply was the issuance of an 8-page release that termed the jury's report without the slightest foundation. The press, the instrument best equipped to investigate the situation and come up with independent facts and figures, never made any such investigation. It buried or ignored the recreation reports of the United Parents Association and the grand jury and the resolutions passed by the Negro community organizations and reprinted only the barest handful of letters to the editor. It took Reverend Bishop 14 years to get one printed. In 1950, the Times would send a reporter to Harlem to make his own independent tour, and he would report that playgrounds for many Harlem children were vacant lots in which bare-legged children played on dumps of broken glass, rusty cans, and refuse. But during the 1930s, the press was taking Robert Moses' word for what was being done for the slums. A day-by-day review of the Times, Herald Tribune, and Brooklyn Eagle, and a more cursory review of the city's other major dailies for the entire 1934 to 39 period did not turn up a single editorial even hinting that Moses' playground building program might be neglecting the slums. A typical editorial was the one in the Times that said that Moses was sowing playgrounds over the congested areas of the city as a sower might sow magic seed bidden to flower in the slums. Robert Moses built 10 new community swimming pool complexes in New York City during the 1930s. Because of his fascination with water in general and swimming in particular, Moses gave each of the pools, for which he had obtained a special WPA grant of $10 million, his personal attention. Under his prodding, his architects adorned them with masterful little touches. Over the entrance which divided men from women as they entered the bathhouse at the Corona Pool complex sat a stork wearing an expression that made him look as if he were puzzling over the physical differences in the creatures he had brought into the world. Under his prodding, his architects produced dozens of innovations that would set a new standard for swimming pool construction, public and private, from pool bottoms of wood float rough enough to prevent slipping and smooth enough to permit games during the off-season when the pool was drained, to a totally new type of scum gutter wide enough to let in sunlight that would kill the bacteria whose formation had been a problem in older public pools. He himself solved a problem that had always baffled designers, how to force swimmers to wash their feet before entering the pool by building what the Architectural Forum called tactful depressions, hollows too wide to be jumped, clear across each corridor leading from the locker room to the pool, so that swimmers had no choice but to walk through them and through the special foot-cleansing solution with which they had been filled. Despite the WPA requirements that only the cheapest materials be used, each pool turned out to be a municipal marvel of the first magnitude. And they were hailed as such. Simple materials simply disposed, in designs that were always sound and sometimes brilliant, the forum said. As for their size, the main pool at the three-pool Corona complex is 365 feet long. The forum said, the openings were marked by the publication of statistics which seemed to the reading public all but incredible. The Astoria pool, for instance, was reported to have accommodations for 6,200 bathers. Nobody had heard anything like that before, but it turned out to be literally true. The 10 new pools erected last year, plus two old ones that had been remodeled, now have a combined capacity, as measured by their locker room facilities, of 49,000. The ingenuity that Robert Moses displayed in building swimming pools was not restricted to their design. Moses built one pool in Harlem, in Colonial Park at 146th Street, and he was determined that that was going to be the only pool that Negroes, or Puerto Ricans, whom he classified with Negroes as colored people, were going to use. He didn't want them mixing with white people in other pools, in part because he was afraid, probably with cause, that trouble, fights and riots, would result. In part because, as one of his aides puts it, well, you know how R.M. felt about colored people. The pool at which the danger of mixing was greatest was the one in Thomas Jefferson Park, in LaGuardia's old East Harlem congressional district. This district was white, but the pool, one block in from the East River, was located between 111th and 114th Street. Not only was it close to Negro Harlem, but the city's Puerto Rican population, while still small, was already beginning to outgrow the traditional boundaries of Spanish Harlem, just north of Central Park, and to expand toward the east, toward the pool. By the mid-30s, Puerto Ricans had reached Lexington Avenue, only four blocks away, and some had begun moving onto Third Avenue, only three blocks away. To discourage colored people from using the Thomas Jefferson Pool, Moses, as he had done so successfully at Jones Beach, employed only white lifeguards and attendants. But he was afraid that such flagging might not be a sufficient deterrent to mothers and fathers from the teeming Spanish Harlem tenements who would be aware on a stifling August Sunday that cool water in which their children could play was only a few blocks away. So he took another precaution. Corporation Counsel Windles was astonished at its simplicity. We, Moses and I, were driving around Harlem one afternoon. He was showing me something or other, and I said, "Don't you have this problem with the Negroes overrunning you?" He said, "Well, they don't like cold water, and we've found that that helps." And then, Windles says, Moses told him confidentially that while heating plants at the other swimming pools kept the water at a comfortable 70 degrees, at the Thomas Jefferson Pool, the water was left unheated, so that its temperature, while not cold enough to bother white swimmers, would deter any colored people who happened to enter at once from returning. Whether it was the temperature or the flagging, or the glowering looks flung at Negroes by the park department attendants and lifeguards, one could go to the pool on the hottest summer days, when the slums of Negro and Spanish Harlem a few blocks away sweltered in the heat, and not see a single non-Caucasian face. Negroes who lived only half a mile away, Puerto Ricans who lived three blocks away, would travel instead to Colonial Park, 3 miles away, even though many of them could not afford the bus fare for their families and had to walk all the way. The fact that they didn't use their neighborhood pool, and the explanation for this fact, was never once mentioned by any newspaper or public speaker, or at least not by any public speaker prominent enough to have his speech reported in a newspaper. Moses built an immense park complex on Randall's Island, one equipped with baseball fields, tennis courts, and soccer fields. Only one item was needed to make it a great park: people. But this ingredient was not provided. Moses had said that the island was easily accessible to the slums. Trekking the 2 miles to the island once was evidently enough to convince most slum families differently. Even on weekends, the vast new facilities sat almost empty. As for the Randall's Island Stadium, Moses had demanded 70,000 seats. The WPA had allowed him 22,000. Even this number was, during the stadium's first 5 years of operation, not sold out once. At most events, the attendance was not in the thousands, but the hundreds. The Grand Central, Interborough, and Laurelton Parkways opened early in the summer of 1936, bringing to an even 100 the number of miles of parkway constructed by Moses on Long Island and in New York City since he had conceived his great parkway plan in 1924. At the opening of one stretch of parkway, Fiorello LaGuardia lavished praise on everyone connected with its construction except Moses, and then, reaching up and placing his hand on his park commissioner's shoulder, said earnestly, "I don't have anything to say to you, Bob. Those who came to cheer have stayed to cheer." The city's press had stayed. One editorial opined that the new parkways would, by relieving the traffic load on the southern and northern state parkways, solve the problem of access to Moses' Long Island parks for generations. The new parkways solved the problem for about 3 weeks. It wasn't more than 3 weeks after they opened that I decided to go out to Jones Beach on a Sunday, Paul Windles recalls. I got on the Interborough, and by God, it was as jammed as the southern state ever was. Moses announced that he had the solution: build 45 miles of new parkways, including a great circumferential parkway around Brooklyn and Queens, that would provide motorists of these boroughs and of Manhattan, if the proposed Brooklyn Battery Tunnel was built and linked up with the parkway, with an easier way to reach the island. And, since the parkway would run for 20 miles along the edge of the Brooklyn waterfront, with a wonderful view. Some city planners noticed that the traffic pattern on Long Island had fallen into a set pattern. Every time a new parkway was built, it quickly became jammed with traffic, but the load on the old parkways was not significantly relieved. If this had been the pattern for the first 100 miles of parkways, they wondered, might it not be the pattern for the next 45 also? Perhaps consideration should be given to trying to ease Long Island's traffic problem by other means, specifically the improved mass transit that the Regional Plan Association and other reform-backed groups had been proposing for a decade. The RPA ventured to raise this suggestion again, and it was backed by other planners and by some reformers. But their voices were drowned out by the flood of praise for Moses' idea. Said the son of the circumferential proposal, "When it's done, you South Brooklynites can hitch up the old buggy and be in the Bronx before a Harvard man could say Greenpernt." The Triborough Bridge opened on July 11, 1936. Even men familiar with large-scale public works were awed by this one. From the engineering point of view, it is one of the greatest in the world, as it is one of the biggest, PWA Administrator Ickes wrote in his diary. General Hugh Johnson wrote in his syndicated column, "The Triborough Bridge in New York City is one of the greatest accomplishments of man in the most fascinating department of civil engineering, bridge building." Harry Hopkins said that, "Of 70,000 WPA projects in the United States, there is none of which we are prouder." The awe and the pride was shared by the city. The imagination with which the whole project was conceived and the integrity with which it has been carried out reaffirms our faith in the ways of democratic government, the Times editorialized. City officialdom and press assured the public that the project would, as Moses had promised, provide at a single stroke a solution to most of the traffic problems between Long Island and New York. A tour over the Triborough Bridge yesterday by two newspaper reporters revealed that the huge structure is up to the expectations of the public and the promises of its builders, both in beauty and in usefulness, the Times said. Trips from northern Queens to 125th Street in Manhattan, which previously had required, in the best of conditions, 45 minutes via the Queensboro Bridge, would henceforth be negotiated in as little as 16 minutes, reporters reported. Police Commissioner Valentine said that the opening of the bridge would sharply reduce traffic on all the East River spans, on the Queensboro by from 40% to 50%. On August 17, 1936, a little more than a month after the Triborough Bridge opened, Long Island's parkways were the scene of what some observers called the greatest traffic tie-up in the history of the metropolitan area. Referring to it as a cross-country traffic jam, the Herald Tribune was forced to conclude that the bridge had, at least indirectly, caused it. Apparently, a Monday morning editorial quarterbacked, the motoring residents of the Bronx had all discovered at the same moment that the Triborough brought them within easy time of Jones Beach and other cool and pleasant resorts on the south shore of Long Island, and had decided at the same moment to head for the ocean by way of the new bridge and the Grand Central Parkway. And nearly all of them got stuck, as did countless other motorists going to and from Long Island. Public officials responded with alarm. "The Interborough Parkway, barely opened, was already impossible," Brooklyn Borough President Ingersoll noted. Moses said he knew what to do: build more parkways in the Bronx and Westchester. "It's time we gave Westchester a break," including the Hutchinson River Parkway extension, and on Long Island not only rush the construction of the parkways he had already proposed, but also build new roads that would not be restricted, as parkways were, to private automobiles, but would also carry commercial traffic. In particular, he proposed a road down the center of Long Island, the road that would, when finally built, be known as the Long Island Expressway. "Yes," agreed Ingersoll, "that was what was needed." "Yes, indeed," said the Herald Tribune, and the rest of New York's press. The Wantagh State Parkway extension was opened on December 17, 1938, 3 months ahead of schedule. Reminiscing in the brochure distributed at the ribbon-cutting ceremony, Moses noted that in the nearly 15 years since he had planned a metropolitan area transportation system, 110 miles of parkway including 191 grade-eliminating bridges, had been completed in New York City and on Long Island, and so had the Henry Hudson, Triborough, and Marine Parkway bridges. The arterial system he had created, he said, was unparalleled. And it had had to be, for so was the metropolitan area's traffic problem. And, he said, his program had been successful. Today, he said, we are well on our way toward a sensible solution of this problem in the metropolitan area. In his speech at a luncheon held afterwards at Jones Beach, Moses repeated this theme. 1,000 guests applauded enthusiastically. The Wantagh State Parkway extension did not receive its first real test of traffic easing capacity until the first warm weekend morning of 1939. On that morning, it was jammed bumper to bumper for more than 3 miles. Traffic experts could not understand where those cars had come from. The other Long Island parkways, after all, were just as jammed as ever. 4 months after the Triborough Bridge opened, Othmar Ammann gave a speech on its operation to the American Society of Civil Engineers. In it, Triborough's chief engineer announced that traffic on the span was running considerably ahead of estimates. The opening of a bridge was big news, but its operation was not. Most newspapers did not even bother to send a reporter to cover the speech. The Times did, and Ammann spoke with him after the meeting and provided him with a further bit of information. Despite the heavy volume on the Triborough Bridge, Ammann said, the relief of the traffic load on the Queensborough Bridge has not been as great as expected. But the Times editors evidently did not consider this fact particularly noteworthy. They devoted only 4 paragraphs to the story and buried it at the bottom of page 26. But Ammann's statement was a hint, the only published hint New Yorkers were given during all of 1936, of certain developments that were puzzling and beginning to worry the city's traffic experts. Traffic on Triborough was indeed running ahead of estimates, far ahead. Before its opening, Moses, on the basis of Jack Madigan's figures, had estimated that 8 million vehicles would use the bridge during its first year of operation. Within 4 months, the estimate was increased to 9 million. 3 months later, it was 10 million, and the counts at the Randall's Island Toll Complex showed that traffic was rising more sharply every month. There began to be reports of traffic tie-ups on the huge new structure. But traffic on the 4 other East River bridges was not falling off at anything near a comparable rate. The 8 million cars and trucks that Moses had forecast would use Triborough each year were supposed to be cars and trucks that had previously used the other bridges, particularly the Queensborough. Not only Moses, but all traffic experts who had studied the problem had agreed on that. Otherwise, where would these cars and trucks come from? Yet traffic on the other bridges, down about 15% immediately following Triborough's opening, was creeping higher again month by month, back within 2 years, almost to the pre-Triborough level. Traffic between Long Island and New York had, before Triborough's opening, flooded the 22 lanes available on the 4 old bridges. Suddenly, the traffic between Long Island and New York had become so heavy that it was also flooding 8 new lanes, the new lanes of the Triborough Bridge, and it was hardly any lighter than before on the old bridges. Traffic between the island and the city had been increasing before, of course, increasing steadily, but never had it increased at this rate. If traffic between the island and the city was a stream, something had suddenly opened the sluice gates much wider than they had ever been before, and the more the traffic experts studied the problem, the more difficult it was for them to avoid the conclusion that the something was the only new element in the situation, nothing other than the Triborough Bridge itself. Somehow, in ways they did not even pretend to understand, the construction of this bridge, the most gigantic and modern traffic sorting and conveying machine in the world, had not only failed to cure the traffic problem it was supposed to solve, but had actually made it worse. Moses was convinced he knew the solution to the problem. Build another bridge. Within a year after Triborough had opened, he was proposing the construction, 1 mile to the east, of the Bronx Whitestone that would, by tying directly into the Hutchinson River Parkway to the north, enable motorists from the East Bronx, Westchester, Connecticut, and New England to get to Long Island without using Triborough. For the first time, one of Moses' transportation proposals met with less than unanimous support from good government groups. The Regional Plan Association said that such a bridge should not be built unless provision was made on it for railroad trains as well as cars, so that a rapid transit tie-in between Long Island and the Bronx, Westchester, and Connecticut could be established. The tie-in did not have to be immediate, the RPA said. Construction of the rapid transit system could wait until the need for it had been proven and financing was available. But provision for it should be made immediately. All that was required was to make the bridge wide enough for two lanes of tracks as well as for automobiles, or to build a second deck for the tracks. Or, if Moses did not want to adopt either of these courses at the present time, to make the bridge foundations and towers strong enough so that, should at some later date the rapid transit link be desired, the bridge could support a second deck that would be built at that time. If provision was made now, while the bridge was being planned, the RPA said, it could be made cheaply at a minor increase in the cost of the bridge. If it was not made, a whole new bridge would have to be constructed from scratch when the rapid transit link proved necessary, and the cost would be tremendous. It might even prove prohibitive, preventing construction of such a link entirely. Failure to make provision for a rapid transit link as part of the Bronx-Whitestone Bridge, the RPA said, could therefore condemn Long Island forever to be linked to the north only through roads, which would mean that no matter how much population increased in the metropolitan area, the only means of reaching the island from the north would still be by automobile, and this would condemn Long Island to future inundation by larger and larger numbers of automobiles. But Moses refused even to consider its proposal, and the RPA received no editorial support. Without opposition from a single city official, he built the Bronx-Whitestone Bridge without any provision for a rail link, opening it 3 full months ahead of schedule on April 29, 1939. During 1940, its first full year of operation, 6,317,489 vehicles passed through the Bronx-Whitestone's toll booths, cramming its 4 lanes to capacity and causing massive tie-ups on it. Traffic on the Triborough was reduced by 122,519 vehicles. Traffic on the other 4 East River bridges was reduced not at all. In fact, it rose slightly. Somehow, the new bridge had generated, in a single year, more than 6 million new on-and-off island motor trips. It had not improved the traffic situation on the old bridges at all. What had been the net effect of its $17,785,000 construction, or, in fact, of the construction of both it and the Triborough Bridge, on the traffic problem these bridges were built to solve? Before they existed, 4 bridges had connected Long Island with the rest of the world, and they had all been jammed. Now, 6 bridges connected Long Island with the rest of the world, and they were all jammed. By dumping a tremendous new load on the Long Island parkways, the Bronx-Whitestone Bridge made the traffic tie-ups on them noticeably worse. Shortly after the bridge opened, Moses completed the road linking the bridge with Westchester County, the Hutchinson River Parkway. Soon, that was jammed too. The Gowanus Parkway, the elevated highway Moses placed atop the pillars of the old BMT elevated line on Brooklyn's 3rd Avenue, was opened on November 1, 1941, just in time for another mayoral election. When Commissioner Moses finds the surface of the earth too congested for one of his parkways, he lifts the road into the air and continues it on its way, the Times editorialized. A busy, crowded region lay in Mr. Moses' path, too heavily built up for a leisurely landscaped parkway. The problem was solved successfully. Beginning today, Brooklyn reaps a new, incalculable highway benefit. Brooklyn's borough president called Moses an artist, who, in his own field, ranked with Leonardo da Vinci. The canvas on which Moses had drawn the Gowanus creation was a neighborhood known as Sunset Park. Its residents had pleaded with Moses to build the parkway not along 3rd Avenue, but along 2nd, one block to the west, near the waterfront. 2nd Avenue ran not through a neighborhood, but through the middle of Bush Terminal, a 200-acre agglomeration of piers, railroad sidings, lofts, and factories that was already so noisy with the clatter of trucks and freight cars that the noise generated by a few more lanes of traffic would hardly be noticed. Comptroller McGoldrick, a resident of Sunset Park, had agreed with them. He pointed out that the city had been planning to tear down the elevated line because a new parallel subway had recently been built under 4th Avenue, and the elevated at least let some light in. The parkway would be solid, and it would be wider than the L. It would come right up to the windows of the buildings. The comptroller, along with non-Moses engineers, doubted Moses' contention that using the L pillars would be much cheaper than building a whole new parkway, particularly since it would have to swing back to the shore after only 1 mile, a distance long enough to permanently blight a neighborhood, but not to make a substantial difference in cost. Moses had replied by telling the Board of Estimate that Sunset Park wasn't particularly worth saving because it was a slum.
A slum? That wasn't a slum, says Kathy Caterine, who lived in Sunset Park. That was a very nice neighborhood. It was poor, but clean poor.
Actually, part of the area was dirty poor. Blight spawned in the dirt and noise of the Bush Terminal piers, warehouses, factories, and railroad sidings along the waterfront had oozed inland along the side streets, forcing clean poor families to flee before it and leaving the old brownstone and red brick front houses to derelicts, winos, and whores. But that was just part of the area, and it wasn't what families like the Caterines thought of as the neighborhood at all. What they thought of as Sunset Park, the area extending from west of 3rd Avenue all the way to 8th, and from 36th Street south to 63rd, and containing some 70,000 people, half of them Norwegians, the rest Finns, Danes, Irish, and Germans, had been menaced by that blight for at least 30 years, but they had always stood it off. Although it had spread inland as far as 2nd Avenue by the time of World War I, that was where it stopped. In 1940, it had not gotten even a foothold on the side streets between 2nd and 3rd. And despite the Depression, which hit especially hard at a neighborhood of skilled carpenters and house painters and plumbers, 60% of Sunset Park men were members of trade unions, they had made a world of their own. It was indeed, as Kathy Caterine said, a clean world. The brick fronts and brownstones were immaculate. One could walk by them any morning and see the housewives sanding and scrubbing their stoops. Even the sidewalks were swept. The little plots of grass that their owners proudly called lawns may have been tiny, but they were lush green and neatly trimmed. But it was more than clean. It was quiet and peaceful. There were many trees lining the streets, but few cars.
Not many people around there had cars then, recalls Hertha Smalgo. When people wanted to go to work or to the city, they took the elevated.
And warm and friendly. Every summer brought a round of block parties, street lamps festooned with streamers, women and girls in gay peasant blouses from their native lands, folk singers with their accordions singing the old songs, long tables covered with tablecloths washed and washed again until they gleamed snowy under the lamps, and with heaping bowls of kalalatikko and hernieroka. In Finntown, the section of Sunset Park east of 5th Avenue and south of 36th Street that contained half a dozen public saunas, there were also half a dozen cooperative apartment houses, and many of the same families had been living in them for a quarter of a century. In the evening, families walked together to the bluff of Sunset Park to look out over ship-filled New York Harbor. Girls like Kathy Caterine, who grew up there, married boys from the neighborhood and raised their own families there, because we wouldn't want to live anywhere else. The heart of the neighborhood, the focal point that gave it unity and a sense of community, was 3rd Avenue. Lining it, along with newsstands off which 9,000 Nordisk Tidendes were sold every day, were 7 movie theaters, dozens of tiny restaurants run by couples and featuring recipes from the old countries, little restaurants but good,
and so many you wouldn't know where to go for lunch, recalls Harold Benson, whose hardware store was on 3rd Avenue at 54th Street, and scores of small, friendly mama and papa stores. The Northland Gift Shop, the Finnish Bookstore, a hardware store that looked like a general store out of the Old West, a butcher shop that raffled off 25 big turkeys every Christmas, that occupied the ground floor of 3- and 4-story brick fronts in which Mama and Papa lived upstairs with the children. The avenue was always busy, people shopping or window shopping or just walking, Benson recalls. The L overhead was noisy, but, the shopkeepers say, you got used to the trains, and anyway, when they built the new subway under 4th Avenue, we thought it was going to be torn down. The soot and cinders that wafted down from the L were annoying, but the shopkeepers kept the sidewalks clean by sweeping them morning, noon, and night. Clean? Kathy Caterine recalls. Those were the cleanest stores you ever saw. And the L made 3rd Avenue even more of a focal point for a neighborhood in which not many people had cars. The husbands all took it to work, says Kathy Wild, so there were always people coming to 3rd Avenue to take it. This made the avenue even busier. Neighborhood girls didn't hesitate to walk down to the movies at night in pairs or to go shopping in the evening alone. You would think the L would have been a divider of the neighborhood, but it wasn't really, says Miss Wild. In a way, because everybody used it, it brought it closer together. 3rd Avenue was never an aesthetic avenue, but it was a nice avenue. If 3rd Avenue was the heart of the neighborhood, Moses tore it out. Relocation began the procedure. The Board of Estimate had approved the 3rd Avenue route under the impression that because Moses was using an already existing facility, the old L structure, no new right-of-way would be required, and hence no families would have to be evicted from their homes. But after the approval was given, the board found that that impression was not quite accurate. It was off, in fact, by some 100 stores and 1,300 families. Some buildings had to be torn down because, while an L did not need entrance and exit ramps, a highway did, and a single entrance ramp took half a block of homes. But this need accounted for only a minor percentage of the relocations. Most of the buildings that were torn down, and every building on one side of 3rd Avenue between 39th and 63rd Streets was torn down, had to go because Moses would not allow trucks on his parkways, and so that he would build it instead of the city, he classified this elevated highway through a densely packed urban area, a highway unadorned by a single tree, as a parkway. Since Moses' Brooklyn Battery Tunnel would pour trucks as well as cars into Brooklyn just north of Sunset Park, and since trucks as well as cars would need a route south, he decided to make 3rd Avenue that route, by making that 4-lane street under the parkway into a 10-lane highway. The L had cast a shadow over 3rd Avenue, but the L had been 40 feet wide. The Gowanus was 94 feet wide. Its shadow was more than twice as broad, and more than twice as dark. The gaps between railroad ties had made the L's shadow a Venetian blind shadow. Sunlight had come through it as if through the slats of an opened blind. A highway was a concrete slab, without gaps. The construction of the Gowanus Parkway, laying a concrete slab on top of lively, bustling 3rd Avenue, buried the avenue in shadow, and when the parkway was completed, the avenue was cast forever into darkness and gloom, and its bustle and life were forever gone. And through that shadow, down on the 10-lane surface road beneath the parkway, rumbled, from before dawn until after dark, after the opening of the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel flooded the area with freight traffic, regiments, brigades, divisions of huge tractor-trailer trucks, engines gunning and backfiring, horns blasting, brakes screeching, so that a tape recording of 3rd Avenue at midday could have been used as the soundtrack for a movie of a George Patton tank column. And from above, from the parkway itself, came the continual surging, dull, surf-like roar, punctuated, of course, by more backfires and blasts and screeches of the cars passing overhead. Once Third Avenue had been friendly. Now it was frightening. It was made more frightening by the absence of people. Stores, restaurants, and theaters had brought people to Third Avenue. Now half the stores, restaurants, and theaters were gone. The L had brought people through Third Avenue on their way to and from its stations. The Parkway did not. Moreover, although the L had been a huge, gloomy structure, it was, as Kathy Wilde puts it, one that people from the neighborhood related to. They traveled on it. They were familiar with it. The Parkway was something unfamiliar and strange. There were no lights underneath it, and it always seemed damp there. Condensation on the tubular steel supporting pillars caused a constant dripping on the street. The highway was something different, Miss Wilde says. It was noise, dirt, accidents, not lighted, a garbage dump, drag races along it in the night, wild kids, something totally negative. It was a tremendous psychological barrier. In a way, you could say that people feared the highway. It was something to stay away from. It was a physical barrier, too. Elderly persons and mothers with small children found Third Avenue frightening, not only because it was negative, but because it was wide. Crossing the 10-lane truck road, wider than a football field, was even more of a problem because the traffic lights never seemed to allow enough time for anyone not in the best of health to get across. Sunset Park families began to do their shopping in stores that were not on Third Avenue. Once, the avenue had been a place for people. Robert Moses had made it a place for cars. And as the avenue's roadway became more crowded, its sidewalks began to empty. The vicious gyre of urban decay began and widened. Because there weren't as many people shopping on Third Avenue, there weren't enough to support the avenue's stores and restaurants. Not even the half of the stores and restaurants that remained after the widening. One by one, they began to close. Because there weren't as many stores and restaurants, people began doing their shopping and dining out elsewhere, and then there were even fewer people on Third Avenue. Because the streets in the evening were no longer filled with people, more people who might have gone to Third Avenue in the evening stayed away. Fewer people meant even less business. One by one, the shops and restaurants closed. The shop that had raffled off 25 turkeys raffled off 10 now, and then one, and then it was gone. And since the owners of many of the stores had lived in the apartments over them, when they were forced to move their businesses out of the neighborhood, they were forced to move their families out too, and those families had provided customers for other stores. Not only Third Avenue was wrecked by the road, so were the side streets between it and the waterfront. With Moses Road and Tunnel making Sunset Park more accessible to trucks, industries requiring truck traffic, including two large new plants, one a division of Bethlehem Steel, the other a division of American Machine and Foundry, moved onto Sunset Park's waterfront, already crowded with industrial activity. And the truck traffic for all these factories had no way to get to and from them from Third Avenue except through those narrow streets, between whose parked cars the children of the neighborhood had always played.
There was just so much traffic on those little streets that you wouldn't believe it, Kathy Caterine recalls.
The death of one little boy, hit by a huge tractor trailer in the street right in front of his house, was enough. Faster and faster, the residents of the side streets began to move out.
The whole area died with the road, a resident would marvel, and it died so quick.
Soon it was, in his words, a ghost town. Along the avenue and on adjacent side streets, rows of brownstone and brick front buildings that had held stores and apartments, the stores and apartments that had stood as a bulwark between Sunset Park and the slum to the west, began to be vacated. Their rooms, the rooms that had been kept so clean and neat, stood empty. And into them came what the neighborhood had always feared.
Third Avenue became the place you could get sex, Kathy Caterine recalls. Everybody knew about it.
Drunks as well as whores roamed the avenue, catching drinks until they fell asleep in doorways. Cheap saloons opened in some of the abandoned stores. Soon there were street gangs, fighting gangs,
Irish and Puerto Rican teenagers seeping down from the notorious Red Hook section to continue their racial warfare and prey on passers-by. The side streets off Third Avenue, streets whose apartments were now filled with families on welfare, families without fathers, and with poor Spanish-speaking families without clothes adequate for the cold New York winters, became places to dump and strip stolen cars. The streets began to be filled with their ravaged hulks. Rotting litter, rain-sodden mattresses, and broken glass filled the sidewalks and gutters. Rats began to grow bold in the rubbish in vacant lots. There were even, to the horror of those residents who remained, drug addicts. With its heart gone, the neighborhood had no will to resist the invasion. There was nothing to hold its people, and as they saw the blight creeping closer, they simply moved away. For more than 30 years, the blight in South Brooklyn had been confined to the waterfront area. Now, thanks to Robert Moses and his parkway, it was on the loose, spreading across Sunset Park. The world of neat little houses and block parties vanished beneath it along the entire 26-block length of the Gowanus Parkway, as far east as 4th Avenue, and, except for a few isolated blocks, as far west as 6th, where the parkway was far enough away so that the community put up a stand and won. Moses steel and concrete lifted into the air above a neighborhood for the convenience of motorists driving through the neighborhood to get somewhere else, had destroyed the neighborhood. Convenience? No sooner would Moses open the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel at one end of the Gowanus Parkway and the Belt Parkway at the other than the Gowanus would be jammed solid with traffic. At rush hours, the traffic trying to get up onto it would be backed up solid, spilling off the ramps and back into the neighborhood for blocks. Because there were no shoulders on the elevated road on which a disabled car could pull off, one disabled car could tie up a whole lane for hours. Moses knew what to do about that, he said. Widen the Gowanus Parkway, creating 6 lanes instead of 4, although there would still be no shoulders. That would bring the road right up to the windows of the apartments that were left along it. The cars would be so close to the buildings that on wet days the spray they kicked up would splatter the apartment windows. No matter, Moses said, the Gowanus would have to be widened. And he widened it. Residents of Sunset Park had pleaded with Moses to build the road along 2nd Avenue instead of 3rd. After it was built and they saw what it had done to their neighborhood, they knew their suggestion had been correct. That was an industrial area anyway. Building it over there wouldn't have changed anything in the area at all, Kathy Caterine said. But no newspaper mentioned that fact. Of all the hundreds of public works that Robert Moses was building in New York City during the 1930s, the one whose creation most clearly manifested the same extraordinary capacities he had displayed on Long Island was the project that arose from the first and longest held of his dreams, the dream of the great highway that went uptown along the water, and of the great park alongside that had made him exclaim to Francis Perkins in 1914, staring from the deck of a Hudson River ferry boat at the muddy wasteland below Riverside Drive, "Couldn't this waterfront be the most beautiful thing in the world?" All the qualities that made Robert Moses a genius of public works were needed for the realization of this dream. Its scope was all but unprecedented in urban America. The West Side Improvement, as he named it, included not only the completion of the long-stalled 5-mile elevated express highway from the southern tip of Manhattan Island to 72nd Street, but also the design and construction of the extension of that highway 6.5 miles north to the northern tip of Manhattan Island, the transformation of 6.5 miles of muddy wasteland into a park that would make beautiful the city's western waterfront, the throwing of a Henry Hudson Bridge across the Harlem River that separated Manhattan from the Bronx, the continuation of the highway through the Bronx to the city line and, beyond the line, to the Sawmill River Parkway, so that the city would have at last a true outlet to the north. And the problems in the way of its realization were unprecedented as well. At last, 20 years after he had dreamed the dream, He had the power in the city that was half of the elixir needed to transfer the dream into reality. But he still didn't have the other half of the elixir. Money. The amount needed was staggering. The work below 72nd Street had been carried out under a 1927 agreement between New York City and the New York Central Railroad, which was anxious for an enlarged freight yard at 30th Street and longer covered train assembling tracks further uptown because of the introduction of diesel locomotives, which could pull longer trains than steam locomotives. Under the agreement, the city gave the railroad land for an enlarged yard and for depressed tracks leading to it. The railroad, in return, surrendered its permanent right-of-way through Riverside Park and down 11th Avenue, and the railroad and city, under an incredibly complicated arrangement, were to share the cost of constructing a west side elevated highway from the Battery north to 72nd Street, the southern border of Riverside Park, as well as the cost of covering the railroad's tracks through the park and through its northerly extension, Fort Washington Park, which ran to 192nd Street. The public used the name Riverside Park to refer to both parks, and so, for the sake of simplicity, will this book. By 1929, the city, proceeding with the highway in typical Tammany fashion, down to its adornment with millions of dollars worth of granite, had spent $25 million as its share of the job, and the railroad had spent $84 million for a total of $109 million. And when the Depression brought both railroad and city to the brink of bankruptcy and forced the halt of work, the job was not nearly done. Out of 120 blocks in the park, for example, the tracks had been covered for only the first seven between 72nd and 79th Streets. $20 million might be needed to complete the highway and track depressing operations below Riverside Park alone, and Moses' preliminary estimates of the rest of the work indicated that the amount of money needed to finish the whole West Side improvement might well equal the $109 million already spent. And the immensity of this amount was only part of the problem. From a political point of view, what seemed to make obtaining it almost impossible was the 1927 agreement, which provided that a substantial part of the cost of the improvement was to be borne by the New York Central. The city's taxpayers had been aroused by decades of questionable dealings between the railroad and complacent city officials, dealings such as the one that had given the railroad the permanent right-of-way through a city park and down a city avenue in the first place. They obviously would view any attempt to use their money to relieve the railroad of its obligation as another giveaway. No sensible politician would dare to suggest such an arrangement. The railroad share of the West Side improvement was going to have to be paid by the railroad, or there wasn't going to be any improvement. But the railroad was in no position to pay, and obviously wasn't going to be for years to come. $109 million was a terrible obstacle to place between a man and his dream. Since the turn of the century, other men had been attempting to obtain just a small portion of that sum, enough to build the bridge over the Harlem River and short approach roads. No one but Moses had come up with a fully thought-out plan for the reclamation of Riverside Park, and had never come close to obtaining funds for even those limited improvements. On five separate occasions since 1904, the city had drawn up plans for a Henry Hudson Bridge, and when Moses drove up to the Harlem in 1934, the only trace of the plans he could find was the 100-foot-high column without a statue on top of it and a number of faded billboards, one, it seemed, for every city administration of those 30 years, proclaiming the imminent start of construction. Couple the amount needed with the fact that a substantial part of it had to be provided by a near-bankrupt railroad, and, even to Moses' aides, who had watched R.M. work fiscal magic before, the obstacle looked insurmountable. They watched R.M. set out to surmount it. Under one part of the 1927 agreement, the New York Central had agreed to pay the city $5 million, and the city had agreed that it would spend that money only on the West Side improvement. Under another part of the agreement, the railroad had agreed to pay outright part of the cost of roofing its tracks in Riverside Park. $3,200,000 of the track roofing cost was still outstanding, which meant that the railroad owed the city a total of $8,200,000. If Moses could get this money from the railroad, he would have taken at least a first step toward the realization of his $109 million dream. But the railroad didn't have it. In order for him to get the money from the railroad would have to get it from somewhere else first. Since the Central's own sources of credit were exhausted, Moses would have to obtain the money for the railroad himself. And he would have to give the money to the railroad's hard-eyed directors under